No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello, and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which hopes to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in with your commentary at 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype questions or comments to BBSRADIOPR. Call in and be part of the conversation, especially tonight. Tonight's a special night. Let me introduce my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are you?
I'm terrific, Michael, and I'm actually stunned and astonished that you claim that we've been partners on the program for 4 years.
Yeah. That's what we're going to talk about first. Well, we're not going to talk about it first. We're going to talk about it second. But yes, absolutely. And I was stunned by that. Now, our expert research department, Karen, the other day, that it was had been 4 years. Yeah.
My goodness.
What? How could that be?
Unbelievable.
But first, let me say something about Deborah Emerson.
Yes.
Deborah, you know, a lot of people work behind the scenes to make this show happen, and Deborah's one of them. She's the person that does all our PR and social media and stuff. She's great. She had a birthday this week, so I want to wish her a happy birthday and thank her for all the wonderful things she does for the show. You people, our listeners, probably don't know that Deborah lived in Paradise, California, and lost her home and everything in the terrible fires that they had earlier this year, and she had to relocate. But you know what? Her attitude never changed about anything. She has such a great spirit, and she was always so willing, is always so willing to help us, and she's an amazing part of the team. So I just want to wish her a happy birthday and say thank you for everything. And you know, Maria, I think that you meet certain people in life because that's supposed to happen. I know that sounds a little, mystical or something, but I really believe that. And I think that really what we have here at BBS Radio is like a family as much as it is a working relationship. You know, we all like each other. We love doing the show. And, certainly one of the most important elements of that is you. You've been on the show for 4 years, and you've changed it dramatically. You know, I started this show with a dear friend of mine, Kathleen, and we decided to do it because we thought we needed to get, America talking to each other. And when Kathleen could no longer do it, because she took a job as a lobbyist, and lobbyists don't like Democrats or Republicans. They like everybody. So yeah. they don't want their employees doing anything that, you know, smacks of partisanship, because they don't want to annoy the other side. So she had to leave the show, and I was stuck. I didn't know what to do. I did the show myself a couple times, and it was horrible. And so I knew I needed a co-host, and I came up with this brilliant idea that I would get several different people to co-host. And you were the first person I called, you're a Republican, you're a woman on the West Coast. I said, this is perfect, right? You know, this is what we need. We need a liberal guy, a liberal Democrat on the East Coast, and a liberal Republican woman on the West Coast. We'll have different perspectives. It'll be good for the show. And really shocked me when you agreed to do it all the time. And you've just been great. The show's more professional than it's ever been, you've just made a tremendous amount of difference. So happy anniversary, and thanks so much for doing this. I don't know why you dedicate so much of your time to me, but I certainly appreciate it.
Just as a backstory, thank you for that, Michael. It was more than gracious. And yes, about Deborah and Karen and Doug and Don at BBS Radio, we are a family of sorts, week in and week out. And between your schedule and mine, there are probably not too many other individuals on the planet that are as busy as we are together. And yet somehow most of the Sundays, year in and year out, we've been able to carve out the time to make this show a priority, which it is in my life. And having cut my teeth on traditional terrestrial talk radio decades ago, and having had a career in it, and I was one of the few talk radio host females who was an anchor in and of myself. I didn't have a co-host. I had news and I had traffic, but and I also didn't do politics in general, because I said there's a lot of angry white men who are doing it really well. And I wanted to talk about current events and newsmakers and lifestyle and health and relationships, which is, I think, what most of us spend most of our lives doing, not focusing in on politics, even though we pay attention to it. But when you actually approached me to be a guest on your program twice when Kathleen was your co-host.
Right.
And both of you said, gosh, that was a reasonable conversation between people with two different kind of points of view, even though you and I have discovered subsequently that we probably agree in about 85%, if not 90% of most of the things, because I am a liberal Republican, as you said, which people are probably saying, huh, how does that work? What does that mean? But it's been stimulating also because, Michael, you offer me and our listeners a door open into a world that people hear about but don't really know what that means, i.e. a delegate, a superdelegate, somebody who's worked on campaigns from the grassroots up, as you have in your illustrious career. So I think you're kind of pulling the curtain aside a little bit to what politics can be, not just what we see and read. And that is what I think is also fascinating about shadow politics, because you walk the walk. Not to mention, you live in the District of Columbia. You're in the middle of the heartland of where it all happens. And every time I'm there, which I've been fortunate to be in D.C. now four times in the last 18 months, I still can't get over all the black sedan SUVs that zip around, all the helicopters that fly over, you know, Air Force One and all of that stuff. And that goes on in your life on a day-to-day basis.
Well, you know, we have a somewhat different perspective, I believe, on it. It's funny when you live here for a while, you start to see the signs. So if you go through two intersections and there's police officers on motorcycles sitting at the intersection, the first thought that pops into your head, you know, as a Washingtonian is, let me get the hell out of here quickly before they shut down all the streets and something, you know, and I'm stuck here for 25 minutes. So that one car can go by, you know, it's kind of annoying sometimes. But I guess you get numb to it somewhat, but you know, I don't have any problem admitting this, and I don't know. I guess it's not cool in Washington D.C., but when I go into the Capitol, I'm awestruck. You know, when I'm in the White House, I just find it amazing. It's great. We once I got to tell you, this thought just popped into my head. We once took our kids through the White House at Christmas time, and you know they have different trees in each room, and the trees are all covered with ornaments, and many of them are 100 years old or older. You know, they're like the ornament that Abraham Lincoln hung on the tree. You know, they're priceless. So we went through the White House one time, Pat and I, with Nick, who was like maybe three or four, and all Nick wanted to do was grab the ornaments. So Pat had a death grip on them, you know, and I think there was a Secret Service guy that followed us through the whole tour, just waiting for Nick to snatch something. But thank God he never did. But yeah, I still, you know, that's all the stuff I studied in school, just like everybody else, and I'm just amazed when I'm around it. And you know, we'll get back to more wonderful things about Maria, too. But first, let me say that we're on the subject of Congress. We got a new co-sponsor on our bill this week.
Wow.
His name is Jim Costa, and you'll never guess where he's from.
California.
He's from California, 16th.
How many does that make now?
It's like 45. And New York second with like 19.
Wow.
You guys are just like, yeah, like off the charts, you know. They talk about retrocession, which would be for us to recede back to Maryland. But we can do it to any state, technically. So maybe we should retrocede to California, where at least we know people like us, right?
Yeah, we're not even like purple. We're blue, blue, blue.
yeah, right. We'd fit right in.
Yes, you would. You would fit right in.
We could be part of the new strange state that they want to create, the three strange states they want to create.
Well, I wonder what you'd bring to our fifth largest world economy. Maybe you'd bump us to fourth.
Yeah, we're a little city, 10 miles square. Less than 10 miles square. I don't know how big L.A. is, but you could probably fit D.C. neatly inside L.A. with no problem. And we have a $15 billion budget. We have a bigger budget than 22 states.
Yeah, that's really something. That's uncanny. Yeah, I'm glad
really,
you brought that up.
The economy just
keeps putting it in perspective about D.C. for statehood. And I know you've got something pretty spectacular, special, and much needed going on tomorrow. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, but first I want to say how heartbroken I am at the loss of two really big advocates for D.C. statehood and just tremendous people. And that's Representative Elijah Cummings, who was a representative from Baltimore. And we just found out that Representative John Conyers, who represents Detroit. Now, I don't know if Conyers ran for re-election, to be honest with you. I didn't follow it because there was a scandal. He was part of the Me Too thing. There were several
accusers.
In his office. And I can't remember if he ran for re-election or not, but I can tell you that I'm not excusing that behavior on any sense. But if it's true, I don't think they ever adjudicated it. But he was always very kind to me. He met with me. People might not know this, but he was considered, even by jazz musicians, an expert on jazz. He had an amazing collection of American jazz and knew everything there was to know about it. So he was a fascinating guy to be around. You know, of course, Elijah Cummings was one of those people that just was strong and forthright and a leader in civil rights everywhere. And both of them were co-signers of the bill, and we'll miss their influence greatly. So,
well, and what a great memorial. And I mean, we should all be so lucky to be remembered so fondly and passionately and articulately with people so importantly. And what a shame that at 68 we won't have his grace any longer.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I watched, the one thing I did watch was I watched both, I'm preparing for this big meeting that we're going to talk about in a minute tomorrow, so I really didn't go to the funeral in Baltimore. I didn't think I'd be missed, but I did listen to the eulogies from President Clinton and President Obama, and they were great. And you know what? I found Clinton so much, I thought his was great, But the way Obama, God, I wish I could speak the way Obama does.
Yeah.
You know, he's just got, it's so
he's melodious,
different.
Not to mention,
yes.
and you know, smart and articulate.
He makes his cadence and everything. It's like he thinks about everything he says before he says it. You know, and you know, he's just got this great, it's like I expected, if I had been around in 1865, that Abraham Lincoln would have talked, you know, 4 score and 7 years ago, our forefathers set forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty. You know, that he has that kind of cadence, and I was used to, you know, I've grown up in Democratic politics, and I was used to more of the, what would we call it, evangelical, you know, the Martin Luther King kind of style
oratory.
In that tradition, but he's like a cross between that and Bill Clinton. You know what I mean? It's somewhere in the middle, and I just find him mesmerizing when he speaks, even though I like more what Clinton had to say. But it's both amazing men. They'll be missed. Both of them had the capacity to reach across the aisle, and that's, boy, that's different, disappearing.
Yeah.
So before we get back on the subject of Maria Sanchez, which we could do a whole show on, believe me, with no problem.
I have something fun to share too about my research.
I'm sorry, Michael. I said, what's going on in California? Here in Washington, it looks like the whole damn state's on fire.
It feels like it. So we have this phenomenon that comes around most Octobers called Santa Ana winds.
Yeah.
And it's this high speed. We get, our temperatures have been in the 90s this week, and then these high winds. And when I was growing up, they always were created a sense of foreboding in me. One, because back in the day we used to have aluminum windows, so it would rattle the windows at night and make it almost impossible to fall asleep because of the racket in the house. And then sometimes an earthquake would happen around the same time. So for me, it's always been, oh, here they come. But now with the wildfires that they're creating, and then these rolling blackouts that PG&E is doing, Pacific Gas and Electric, and also SoCal Electric, like my mom was without power all day Wednesday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. My brother was out power for 72 hours. I talked to Don before we got you on the line, and they're still experiencing. And Deborah actually had a blackout in her relocated place and had to go to somewhere else in order, because she was going to be without power from Saturday through Tuesday. And they say it is our new normal, and it's terrible. So, like my neighbor got, her husband is dependent on oxygen, which requires electricity, and he sleeps in a recliner because he had esophageal cancer, so he's got some cardio and pulmonary issues with breathing. And the last time there was a power failure that wasn't planned, she was out of town. So I sent her a text, and she's like, I have a key to her house and vice versa. Could you check on him? Because he could be stuck in the chair and not have the oxygen. And so then we've developed now a plan B for if and when that happens. Because it happened when I was in D.C. There was another power outage in our neighborhood in the evening, and she was supposed to be out of town, but he had just been admitted to the hospital, so she wasn't. And she said, how eerie would that have been that I had been out of town the two times that we've had an unplanned power outage? So people with health ramifications, they're really at risk, not to mention all the food that goes bad when your refrigerator goes out.
Of course. Of course. And, you know, it's funny, the older you get, the more important, you realize that stuff is, and it is to you because of the things that you're saying. You know, as you get older, it is more important. But my father-in-law put in a generator, and I was like, you know, you can buy these generators. Now, this isn't like something you buy at Home Depot. This is a thing that's like twice the size of your whole house air conditioning unit outside. It's like, you know, it weighs a ton. And it can keep all the essential stuff in your house going indefinitely. Runs off natural gas, And I thought, wow, and what must that cost, right? And I thought to myself, wow, that's kind of extreme. And then I went to visit him, I walked through his neighborhood, there's dozens of them. People
really?
Have them, yeah, because of, and it's a retirement community.
Well, my neighbor looked into it, and she
said
people
go out and, you know, they invest thousands and thousands of dollars in these things because, you know, the power is so important to them.
She said they're like from $3,000 to $8,000, and the one that she was looking at was $5,000, but it does take gasoline, and apparently it's very loud on top of that. So she found alternatives that you can buy that are much more affordable that actually... She was able to do the recliner, the oxygen, and their home landline into one that will have as a backup generator, but it has a finite amount of hours on it. Mm-hmm. And then you can also get one that pinpoints, say, the refrigerator freezer. So she's my little sleuth. She's figuring it all out, and then I'm just going to take advantage of all this research that she's done.
Well, and I don't know. I think you were with me when I pointed this out to you, but I want America to know this. The Congress, they have their own power plant on Capitol Hill. So when the power goes out everywhere in the whole universe, Congress will still have its power. They have their own power plant, and it's big. It's not, I mean,
I would imagine.
You know,
it
takes
supplying.
Up a square block, and it's a gigantic building. And guess what? It's powered by
solar,
coal. Come on, guys, get with it. There's global warming. It's still powered by
coal.
The good news is that I think it's a backup system. I think that it's not something that's used all the time. I think you're on.
Well, especially if they're not in session, right?
Yeah, I would think that if it were up to me, if I was in charge, I would cut the power when they are in session. I would only have it on when they're not in session for the comfort of the tourists and the other people that go up there. But when they're in session, I would definitely cut it
nice.
Off. You know, or flash the lights. You know how they do in a bar when it's last call. I would do that at the start of every session. Okay, drink up, guys. You got 10 minutes. Then we're out of here.
Oh my gosh! I don't recall being in a bar when it closes, so I can't speak to that.
Oh my God! Nobody's that goody two shoes. You've never been in a bar when it closes?
No. I have to say I haven't.
Oh, my God. I lived mostly because, I in my ill-spent youth, I spent a lot of time with my friends who were musicians, and you couldn't talk to them until the bar closed, you know, because they were working.
Oh, right. Of course.
Yeah. So, I've been in a lot of bars when they close, and, I probably shouldn't be saying this on the air, but I even got arrested one time because a friend of mine ordered a round of beers because they came and said last call. Mm-hmm. And we still had like 3/4 of the beer that we were drinking. So when they came and cleared the bottles off the table, which is what they do, they say, this is last call. You know, a half an hour before the bar closes. Then when the bar closes at 2, at least in Washington, D.C., they have to take all the drinks off the table. So they do that, and my friend took the two beers and put them under the table, and then as we walked out, he handed me one. He said, come on, we'll drink this in the car, because driving. There was another guy driving. So we walked out, and as soon as we walked out, the police pulled up and said, what are you doing? And we said, we're 18, of course. We said, nothing. And they go, yes, you are. You're drinking in public. And we're like, oh, no, we're not. We're going to drink in the car. That made him feel better, right?
Oh, my
God. And they're like, nope. And they arrested us. And we had to go to jail. And, we're there for like an hour. And our friends had to come and bail us out. And it was all night. It was, it was ridiculous. But we realized, when it's last call, it's last call. You can't leave the bar with the beer.
Unlike New Orleans.
Good lesson. Huh?
I think
like in New Orleans, where you can drink anywhere as long as it's not in glass.
Yeah, and I think that's the only city in the United States that you can walk and drink and carry
in
public.
French Quarter,
Which I haven't. I have to say, I have been. When I've taken my daughter on cruises, we used to always end the evening going to the disco, so, and we would dance together, and then when some guy would ask her, I'd go retire. So at 2 o'clock, they don't do the flicker things. They just turn on the spotlights. It's like, it's over. The music stops.
Yeah.
And then lately, I have to say, I took her on a cruise 2 years ago. She's like, Mommy, you're just no fun. You don't stay up till 2 a.m. dancing with me anymore. And I said, you're right. I don't.
<Wow. laughs>
Getting too old for that. It's like midnight is about as late as I can go.
Wow, that's the same thing with me, you know. We started the show talking about how I started the show with my friend Kathleen, and you know, we're old political buddies, and we met in the 1980 Democratic convention, where you know, it's a this is probably true of the Republican convention as well, but there's like 25 parties a night, and for the four nights, at least for the four nights, there's at least 100 parties. So
when we were young,
and we met, you know, we were in our 20s, we'd go to like, we'd get off work at 6 o'clock and we'd go to the convention, and that would end at 10 o'clock, and then we'd start going to parties, and the parties would be over at like 4:30 in the morning, and then we'd be back at work at 6 o'clock. And we did this every night for four nights. We were getting like 1 or 2 hours sleep a night. The last time, she went to the last convention that I went to in Philadelphia, 2016. I've been to every one since 1980. And in 2016, we'd go to the first party, and we'd be like, you know, maybe we ought to go back to our, I'm going to go back to my room and watch a movie. You stay if you want. And she'd be like, no, I'll go back to the hotel too, you know. And so, yeah, that was it. One party, you know, two maybe if we, you know, if we started early enough.
Yes.
But, yeah, as you get older, it gets tougher, doesn't it?
And, yes,
you're
it
less,
does.
Less likely to do it.
Or there's less sense of urgency. It might not be that we don't have the stamina. It's just like, I'd rather be in my room in a robe and reading a book.
Right, and you know, it's like you don't have that sense that young people have, and I don't know why. I always had it. Maybe not everybody has it, but that you're going to miss something if you don't go. You know, and then when you get older, you realize that, you know, at the party, you're probably not going to get to sit down and talk to Mick Jagger. You know, that's probably not going to happen for you anyway. And just because he happens to show up, but there are 3,500 people there, you're probably not going to get a chance to talk to him. So you start to say, And then there's a part, you reach a point when you're my age where you could get to talk to him and you'd be like, how interesting could he be? Let me go back to my room. You know,
that's the thing about fame. At the end of the day, they're human beings just like all of us, and yes, they have extraordinary talent, and they've been wildly successful, and they're internationally famous, but they're really people.
And the thing that you find out, right, when you meet some of them, is that for the most part, they're really cool people, which is usually one of the reasons they've made it. They're very nice. It's the people that and as long as you're not annoying, you know, but it's the people that are like almost there that, you know, are sometimes like ridiculously obnoxious. But, you know, in politics anyway, this is what you find. The real powerful people, they're the nicest people, and usually, and they don't argue with you, because if you don't give them what they want, they just go somewhere else and get it. You know,
that's how we should all be.
Who they are. know, and and some of them have been the most gracious people, like Dan Rather. I'd like to try to get Mr.
Absolutely.
Rather on the show. Spent the day with him one time. He was the most gracious person, and he said to me, this is something we all say. We don't say goodbye in Washington, D.C. Nobody says goodbye to each other. Everybody says, let's get together and do lunch. You know, that's like our party as we bump into you on the street or something. We need to get together for coffee, or we need to get together for lunch. And for every person that, every 1,000 people that promises to get together with you for lunch, you have one lunch out of that. You know, the other 999 people never get come through. And Dan Rather said to me, well, if you're ever in New York, we should have lunch. And so, like, well, I don't know, like 2 years later, my wife goes, I'm going to New York for the weekend, and you should come with me because I have a really beautiful hotel room. And she was going up there on business, and she said, you know, all it costs you is a ticket on the train. So I went, great. And then I said, but what am I going to do while you're at the conference all day? And she said, why don't you call Dan Rather? He said he'd have lunch with you. And guess what? He had lunch with me. It was
there
so
you
cool.
go.
Yeah,
there you go.
And had lunch with me.
You know, at the end of the day, and speaking of, and then we got to get into tomorrow, but I'm going to London next month again for more research on the female genital mutilation. And there's a huge coterie of activists that are not only in the UK, but in London in particular, three of whom I have read their books, one of which was published this year about female genital mutilation and social media, and me getting my PhD in media psychology. It couldn't be more. So I have reached out to the women, and all of them have said yes, that they're going to meet with me and be interviewed by me so I can learn more about their activism, what they've done, what's worked, what hasn't worked. It's, you know, so I can craft my dissertation even better. And it's as simple as just reaching out to somebody and sharing a passion.
Right. Well,
I mean,
you know,
I'm just humbled by the fact that they're giving me their time. These are really renowned, super smart. They're all PhDs. Most of them are professors at universities, and they're authors. And they said, sure, when can we meet? I was like, okay, well, these are the dates I'm going to be there. They're like, huh. So I've got three interviews scheduled so far, and two more are pending.
Wow, that's great. Well, we'll have to hear about your experiences, and you know, yeah, that's great. You know, one of the things that I do, and this is a joy for me, is I judge the history fair in Washington, D.C., at the archives every year. And I get middle school kids who are do websites. That's my specialty. Right now, if Karen's listening, she's laughing her tail off because, you know, she considers me totally inept
in technology.
On the computer. Yeah, anything that has anything to do with technology. But some of these things are just wonderful, and this is the finals, you know, that I see. So a lot of the stuff's amazing for kids, but one that really stood out in my mind was, because we have to pick a winner each time, was this young, like, middle school kid who decided to do a project on how, that you would love this, Maria, how the changing images of women on TV changed opportunities for women in the world. So she talked about Lucille Ball, Carol Burnett, and Mary Tyler Moore. Well, she wrote a letter to Carol Burnett and asked Carol Burnett 25 questions, and Carol Burnett answered every one of them.
Aww.
Yeah. For a junior high school kid working on the science, you know, on the project, I was just so stunned by that, and she gave really cute, kind of but insightful answers, you know, and there was some question, I can't remember what it was, it was kind of personal, and she wrote back. Her answer to that question was, buy my book. Buy my book and read about it, you know. But she answered all the kids' 25 questions, and you know, I thought, how cool is that? You know, my wife
Very.
Would die if Carol Burnett walked in the room. She's like, you know, one of
my big
of fan,
huh?
favorite people. Yeah, she's you know, but yeah, you're right. They are for the most part very regular people. So. We're going to have some regular people in a meeting tomorrow, and I want to talk about this a little bit a constituent.
Tell us what brought it about, Michael, because it's obviously an answer to a need, but how did it come up in, like, under your purview?
Well, a constituent called me, and she said, look, I'm really worried about these mass shootings that we see because we're here in the nation's capital, and we're kind of ground zero. You know, we hear about these manifestos and other things that some of these people have done, and I think to myself, well, here aren't we very vulnerable here in Washington, where what a lot of these people rail against, where the seat of government, where liberal Democrats, where, you know, where multiracial society, where our city, we're very, very liberal. You know, aren't we more vulnerable, and shouldn't we find out? She said, what's being done about this? And I said, well, I don't know what's being done. And she said, well, I think we need to find out what's being done. So I agreed with her, and we rented some space at a local college. We rented out the ballroom, and tomorrow we're going to put together a panel of people to come and talk about this. And the people that we put together are, I think, an amazing panel. We have Daron Erickson, who's the outreach person for the American Defamation League, and he's going to talk about hate crimes. We have Wendy Pohlhaus, who's from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the U.S. Attorney, that's federal position, prosecutes crimes in the District of Columbia, like hate crimes. We have a captain from the Metropolitan Police. We have the head of Homeland Security for the District of Columbia. We have the fire chief, who's head of fire and EMS, which is, we're just so glad to have him. He's a great guy. And we have the head of D.C. security for D.C. public schools, because unfortunately, a lot of this stuff happens in schools. So we think we put together a really good panel to talk about this, and for them to get input from the community to hear what you know, the concerns of the community are. And we have a lot of people talking about gun violence in Washington, but we have nobody talking specifically about this. And I don't know if you heard, but, you know, what day goes by. I mean, the more I looked into this, this was, for me, much like FGM. I mean, except that I knew a lot about this, but I didn't really know, you know, the meat of it, of the issue. This year, there have been 335 mass shootings this year at movie theaters, IHOPs, schools, restaurants, and most lately, yesterday at a graduation party. I don't know if you heard about this.
I did not.
Texas, 2 dead, 12 injured at a great graduation party in Texas. 750 people were in attendance when somebody walked in with a semi-automatic handgun and started firing. Killed 2, wounded 12. It was a homecoming for one of Texas A&M's, like, remote campuses, not the main campus, but 750 people at a party venue. You know, one of those places where you specifically rent out for parties and weddings and stuff. The suspect is still at large. And, you know, this is just the latest. And, in fact, when we put the information together, we did, you know, we sent out information that said there had been 335 mass shootings this year, and that was, about 2 weeks ago that we put the information together. There's been 15 since then.
Oh, my gosh.
In the 50 years prior to the Texas tower shooting, you and I are old enough to, well, maybe not you, but I'm old enough to remember this.
Remember,
I don't
know
if most of our listeners remember, but a guy went up into the bell tower at the University of Texas and started shooting at people. In the 50 years prior to that, there had been 25 mass shooting incidents, or an average of 2 mass shootings a year, We're not even at the end of the year, and we're already up to 350. We've gone from two a year to 350 a year. It's just incredible. We've lost 1,200, more than 1,200 people have been killed. Thousands have been wounded. 200 children have lost their lives. It's just amazing. The youngest were only a few months old in some cases. And I can tell you, I just came back from India. And in India, you cannot go into a hotel with having your hotel parking lot without having your car inspected, without being stopped by a bomb barrier and having your car inspected by the authorities. You can't go into a shopping mall without going through a metal detector.
Really?
And yes, I went to the shopping mall. You have to go through a metal detector. It's just like being at the airport. You know,
that's what it sounds
your bags,
like.
You go through the through a metal detector. Yeah. And on the streets, they have this amazing technology. They have cameras that take your picture constantly and compare them to outstanding warrants and stuff. And
they caught
110 people that had warrants so far this year when I was there. And, you know, on the one hand, you go, wow, that's amazing. And then in the other hand, you're like, do we really want this in the hands of government? That, you know, that they know where you are every minute and they know what you're doing every... But
it's hard to argue with their results.
Yeah. Well, and is that where we're headed? Are we headed, you know... Now, in Hyderabad, where I was, there was... they have 7 million people and they only had one gun death this year.
Huh.
Out of 7 million people. So, you know, guns are, you know, one of the things that we need to deal with in this problem. It's not everything, as you know. Most of these guys, more than half of the shooters, have killed themselves as part of the, you know, either on the particular site or near the site. They've killed themselves. So there are red flags out there, and we seem to find them after the fact. You know, we say, oh, he was on the internet and we saw this manifesto, or, oh, you know, we should have known this, or he had a criminal record, or, you know, most of them have some sort of ailment, you know, he's not on his drugs, whatever. And we always seem to find this out after the fact. And what we're hoping to do tomorrow, as we talk about this, is find ways to be preemptive.
And what does that look like? Like, what suggestions are there?
I want to know what people are doing and how can we be preemptive. But are there signs that we should be looking for? Are there things that we can do that we're not doing? Here in the District of Columbia, we've had a couple of incidences, and we have very, very tough gun laws. So are there something we can do with gun laws? Should, you know, so many of these people have semi-automatic weapons. I'm really not sure why you need a semi-automatic weapon if you're not a law enforcement
in the armed
person.
Now,
you're either a member or former member of the NRA, maybe you can answer that question. And I've been around guns most of my life, and I'm not particularly scared of guns, but I'm scared sometimes of the people that have them. But I don't understand why you're allowed to have semi-automatic weapons. I mean, you certainly can't hunt with them.
Well, and I'm not a fan of that in pedestrian hands at all. I don't think that's what our forefathers had it in mind.
I got no problem in gun clubs that secure the weapons. You know,
if
you want to go out and fire an AR-15 on a range, great. Just leave it there and make sure it's secure. Don't allow the guy to take it with him or the woman to take it with him. By the way, of course. Of the 320 people that you know have been involved in recent years in these mass shootings, the perpetrators like three of them are women. You know,
I was going to say that too. That's coming next. But you know, when you said, "Are there signs?" From the field of psychology, they say that those who are thinking about suicide, that there are some signs. It's not nearly as overt as saying, "I want to kill myself," but what we do as a society is we feel like it's not our business, or that if we talk about it, then it's going to lead to more enamorment of it. And the truth is that the more somebody talks to a person who might be inclined, the less likely they will be to follow through, because somehow they're feeling that somebody cares, or that they're being connected with, or that their concerns are noticeable. And I'm wondering about that with gun violence, if there's some sort of precursor in their behavior or in their actions or in their statements or their postings that you might go, that looks a little radical, or that looks a little scary, or that looks something like a warning. Because there's been so many, surely we can gather that evidence to say, what was it like the last 72 hours before they did that?
Well, you know, that you're exactly making the point, right?
Yes.
Are the ways that we can see that and mitigate it? Because I come from an Italian family, and my mother's family, and this is the rule in the Italian family: if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. Okay. So if Uncle Charlie's an alcoholic, but nobody talks about it, it doesn't exist. Therapy? Oh my God! Nobody in my family. Now, I won't say this about my immediate family or my brother, but certainly the last generation of my family, my mother, my father, my grandparents, and my aunts and uncles, every one of those people needed therapy.
Uh-huh.
But nobody ever got it. That was unheard of. So,
well, it was a sign of personal weakness in my family if you needed to go outside for help.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's not the norm anymore. I think people realize that the human condition is subject to frailty and failure. And the more help we can get, perhaps the more successful our journey and the less suffering in that journey.
Yeah, I think that we're more and more coming to this place in our society where it's okay to ask for help. And, I agree. I think that's a good thing. We certainly could all use it. And, you know, it wasn't just our families. It was society, too. You know?
Right.
Both my parents died when I was in high school, and so I reacted by skipping like 150 days of my senior year. I never talked to a counselor, ever once. They never sent me to a counselor to talk to anybody about anything. They just kept letting me back into school. And like, his parents died, let him back in. You know, if anything, they disciplined me.
And if that isn't a cry for help, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cry for help, and then I dropped out, which was even worse. When I think of all the times that what my life would have been if I had remained a high school dropout, I think to myself, they did me a real, real disservice.
They did. And I can only imagine how you must have felt, like nobody cares that I'm not showing up. Nobody's following through.
I didn't see myself as a victim in any sense in those days. I saw myself as I don't know exactly how to put it, but I really never saw myself as a victim. I saw myself I don't know.
Takes a long time.
I have to think a long way back.
Person.
But I remember thinking everybody was wrong and everybody was against me. you know, that somehow, because I was a child, right? And somehow this had been perpetrated against me to screw my life up, that my parents weren't around, that we didn't have any money, that, you know, these weren't things of my making. So I took it personally. And it took a long time to get over that. It really did. And it took some non-traditional therapy, which is that I ran into people that were older and wiser who took an interest in me and you know, helped steer me in the right direction. Or in a different direction. Let's say the right direction. But, And so the idea tomorrow night is to try to get some of this out in the open so that we can deal with it as a community.
How do you, will it be a forum?
A panel with questions from the audience. We're leaving time for the questions. We're going to ask each participant to tell us, you know, what they're doing in this regard. Then I'm going to ask them a series of questions, and then we're going to let the audience ask them a series of questions.
And how long do you envision this to be?
2 hours.
Oh, wow.
You know,
pretty expedient.
Yeah, if, you know, nothing ever starts or ends on time in District Columbia, but it's a Monday night. We didn't want to take up too many people's time. You know, they were kind enough to volunteer to come. Of course, we're in the middle of the World Series. I didn't want to bring it up because I know
your Nats aren't doing well, are they?
You know what? That's a little bitter on your part, Dodgers fan.
I think there's a little
Dodger venom in there, but yeah, well, it just shows how cocky we are in Washington. You know, they won the first two games, so we're like, okay, well, it's going to be over in four. Yeah, not quite, because they showed up to play the last two nights, and we're hoping they do okay tonight. But, you know, we're running out of time, and what I wanted to do, unfortunately, my technology didn't cooperate with me tonight. I don't know if Doug is listening to us, but if you could play us out, Doug, with a song by Bonnie Raitt called Feels Like Home. I never got a chance to say that at the beginning of the show. We usually pick a song at the beginning of the show, but if you can find that, Doug, and put it on, great. It's a song that talks about if this situation that I find myself in at BBS Radio feels like something that should have always been. And I thank you, Maria, for making that happen, and for Deborah and Doug and Karen and everybody else involved in the show.
And Don.
And Don. Yes, I'm sorry, we forgot Don. Yeah, so if we're a family, Maria, what does that make? Doug's like the teenage son, right? But
with
anyway,
his enthusiasm
really
and
like
his willingness and eagerness, right?
Yes, and I'm so thankful for each and every one of you. So we'll see you next week, America.
Yes.
Since this is your fourth anniversary, please finish the show for me. Thanks.
Well, I always want to say thank you, Senator Michael D. Brown, for the opportunity, and thank you to BBS Radio for providing the format. But if it weren't for our listeners, we wouldn't have a reason for being. And so at the end of the day, it's the folks who mark us on their calendar, who download us and listen on demand, that help keep Shadow Politics something that we're able to commit to every Sunday and on demand. And to that, we are exceedingly grateful.
We'll see you next week.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.